Okay, so today I'm on the Zoom call with Mike Miller, who's based in Uganda. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Mike. Now, you obviously sent me a lot of information through, and you tell me you've won money betting on golf since 2001, and it's been your only form of gambling since 2003. Can you elaborate a bit for us, please, on how you've managed that?
I started out as a horse racing bettor. And my father was actually a problem gambling horse racing bettor. So I thought I learned a few lessons off him, but I couldn't make any money betting on horses over the term of a number of years. I then turned to football because I was working in the bookmaking industry at the time, and football was a very big betting sport. Soccer, I guess I should clarify which form of football. I did that for about 18 or 20 months full time in the early 2000s, laying and backing, mostly on Betfair. And I earned a living from it, but I could only grind out about $3,000 a month based on my bank. And that was enough to pay the rent and buy me some food, but not much more than that. So I then turned to golf, which was my other real, had always been my other real betting interest.
Okay, now I was going to ask the question about football, but later on, but now you've mentioned it, we'll start from the beginning. I mean, you make it sound like it's quite an easy job to win $3,000 a month betting on the football. I mean, but most people that have tried it know it's not. What was your sort of age or strategy betting on the football?
Well, it was in the early days, really, of the emergence of the Asian and Asian handicap books. And at that time, they were probably a little bit ahead of the European markets in terms of market moves and a little bit different in terms of opening prices too. So I was really looking for favoured soccer teams that were paying around 210, 220, 230, that the Asian books rated 195 or 2. And that was the basis of my football betting.
Right, just so the Asian books.
Looking for a little bit of an edge.
Yeah, so that edge would have been eroded. Nobody can really replicate that now.
No, probably not.
Okay, so you say you turned to golf. How many years did you bet on golf and lose on it before you cracked it?
If I haven't actually cracked it, probably from 1992 when I had my first golf bet, which was a winner, $50 on Bernhard Langer at 50-1 to win the Masters. Probably until I would say 2003, I felt as though I was properly equipped to bet on golf. And the intervening period entailed thousands of spreadsheet simulations of tournaments, a Microsoft Access database, leading on to the creation of my own bespoke software, I suppose you would call it, where I was able to accumulate everything I wanted to accumulate and to price up golf fields for myself. So that really occurred around 2003.
Okay, now that obviously you've got a background in sort of computers, analytics, statistics, that sort of thing?
Actually, no, probably more the opposite. I was lucky in a sense that I found, after a lot of trying, a computer programmer who could turn my concepts into something I could use.
Okay, now you say your concepts, now you've made this pay for 2 decades. You must have found a unique edge. Are you prepared to give us a little inkling as to what it was?
I think there's a slight edge there in that I track the form of all players on all tours. So that's something like 42 golf tours, about 28 men's and 14 ladies. So as players emerge at the very lowest levels from amateur through to the lowest level tours, I'm tracking their form and performances through. And then they appear on a stage where bookmakers are betting on a tournament, like, for example, European Challenge Tour or LPGA, Corn Ferry Tour. I probably know a little bit more about how good those players are than a lot of bookmakers who are forced to price up that field in an hour, perhaps on a Monday.
Okay, so would you price up a race, would you price up an event yourself and try and then spot the value if they've made a rick?
Yes, for a long time now I've priced up every field on which I think they'll be betting in any given week. So my starting point is my odds or prices for every player. And then the market opens and there'll be variations and I work forward from there.
Okay, now we talk about the various tournaments that you include, because we must say that you know, part of Green Square Golf, which is your statistics. And I signed up and downloaded a lot of information. Well, I can't see it, can you? A lot of information. Now, we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that in a bit, because there's a lot there. But I want to carry on a minute about the betting. In the UK, we have a lot of bookmakers that often cut their own throats, each other's throats, with place terms. Now, do you look for advantageous place terms? And I mean, what would you consider to be the tipping point when it becomes the punter's favour? Because some bookmakers have priced up sort of 10 places on the golf. At what point would you say that the each-way terms become a punter's paradise?
It's difficult because sometimes the win terms vary along with the place terms. So 1/4 the win odds for the place paying 5 or 6 places is okay. 1/5 the win odds paying 8 places is perhaps slightly more attractive. But it depends what type of betting you're doing. My betting involves combining players each way in doubles predominantly. So the more places that I can get, the better. A related challenge is being able to operate and maintain accounts with those bookmakers. That's got more and more difficult over the years. I don't want to sound like I'm big-noting or being big-headed here, but probably had in excess of 50 betting accounts either closed or severely constrained over the past 10 years.
And you mentioned, we'll talk about bookmakers as well in a bit, but you mentioned the early days of the exchanges. So do you get involved with betting sort of in running, so to speak, during a golf tournament?
Occasionally. Excuse me. Generally only during the final perhaps 9 holes on Sunday. And then only if I can see something that looks like a real opportunity. Someone I liked before the tournament is perhaps 3 strokes back, paying 33-1. In a situation where I don't like any of the players who are ahead of them. But it's not a mainstream part of my activity. All of my activity is before the tournaments tee off.
Okay, so you wouldn't habitually hedge out of a position if your bet was well clear and well odds on?
I have a look at the end of each day's play, and if there's an opportunity that's satisfactory to me, then I will. But I don't have the time or the energy to live trade anything, really. So I'm really just looking between rounds and then a little bit of extra focus when the last 9 holes are being played.
And do you look at the other markets for value that might stick out? For example, a match market or something like that. If you sort of spot one that should be, that's the wrong price, would you get involved?
Not really, no. I'm trying to win a lot of money for a small outlay. So I'm really looking for odds that are much higher than head-to-head prices or indeed place prices or or anything else really.
Okay, and you've said that you've done this successfully for two decades. Have you had to tailor your approach over the years? Has it changed from when you started professionally to now?
It hasn't changed a lot. The main things that have changed have been the peripheral challenges, like opening and maintaining a betting account, what sort of things I should do to try and stay below the radar of the risk managers, to what extent I can trust friends or family with larger amounts of money, to what extent I could trust offshore agents equally with, you know, reasonable amounts of money. I got burned in China last year when an agent and all his supporters got arrested in Hong Kong, and all of the money I had with them disappeared. So yeah, the basic approach hasn't changed a lot, but the things I've had to do to actually just simply be able to bet have been the biggest challenge, which is sad.
Okay, Mike, we talked about the extra problems that people like you have to get on with bookmakers, which we'll address again in a minute as well. But is continuing on your approach to betting, because a lot of people like to sort of learn, what has stopped being viable, even if you could get on, that used to be viable when you started, as in punting?
Actually, you stumped me there. I can't think of anything, to be honest.
Okay, so we'll carry straight on with the book. So with golf, I mean, all the form for the layman, anyway, all the form is there to see, apart from obviously the smaller tournaments that you gather the form from that a lot of people may overlook. There's no sort of inside information like there might be on horse racing or secret gallops or anything, or is there? And you covered that with your talking about the tournaments that you do cover that other people don't. But is there anything else that you think you take into account differently to other punters?
Probably. The guy who wrote my software built my thoughts into it, which were mainly based around form, because my feeling is that form is a representation of all of the myriad statistics that some people really get hung up on. And I think statistics, or shot statistics, are like an almost bottomless black hole. So I've taken the view that form represents all of those shot statistics. So what I then do is two things. One is my software looks at trends. It looks at a player's form trend over the entire period that it's been in my database and looks for patterns. For example, guys who may play well around the end of the year. Cameron Smith, perhaps an example. I think all of his wins have been between October and January. So it looks at trends, and then it also attaches a strength of field to every form data point. So a guy who comes into a PGA Tour event with a recent second on the Korn Ferry Tour, my software will convert that second on the Korn Ferry Tour to a PGA placing, which might be 25th. And treat it as such in the analysis and the pricing of that golfer. So that in particular, I think, leads to a tiny bit of an edge I might have when you have, for example, a tournament in Hong Kong on the Asian Tour, and there's a few European Tour players there, and a couple from the Japan Tour and some from the Korean Tour, as well as the Asian Tour regulars, and maybe a couple of other strays from Australia or wherever. I think my software is able to pull all those disparate pieces of form together and construct an intelligent market on the event, or a set of odds on the event.
Okay, now would you, I mean, for starters, do you input all that data yourself?
Yes, I do.
So how much, you know, time of your day would you spend on that sort of thing?
It's roughly 18 hours a week.
Right, okay.
Because
it's half a week's work.
It's not screeds of data, it's just placings. So the only challenge for me is to keep my database integrity by ensuring that every player name is unique. And that's one of the challenges.
Okay. Now, I'm interested that you say you look for trends and you look to see, you stated an example, a player that does well at the end of the year, etc. How deep do you go? Do you then look and see why that may be, just in case the reason for it changes?
No, I don't. I just, because it's only an element of the pricing equation, I just let it occur behind the scenes and I don't question it. Where it might come up is if I rate a player 28-1 and the market opens 66-1, I dig deeper into those scenarios on every player on every tournament. And sometimes the explanation might be what you're hinting at. But if I can't explain it to myself in any way, then I start betting on them.
Okay. Now, I was interested to read that you think the official world ratings are imperfect. Why do you feel that?
Well, they tend to be perfect in that they age form over a two-year period. But a player who gets a win in particular gets a relatively large number of world ranking points compared to the other players in the tournament. And he's not actually that much better than them. And also, a player carries that perhaps one good week of his decade for up to 2 years in his world ranking points. So for several reasons, I mean, they're the best we have and I use them. In fact, they're the starting point for every field that I try and rate. But yeah, for the reasons I've mentioned, they're imperfect because the points mean too much relative to other players and because it may represent one player's career week and he's not going to do it again this week or next month. Like say Ross McGowan, for example, won on the European Tour, when was it, last year? I think it was his first win in 357 starts and he's missed the cut in every start since and may well continue to do so. He's got plenty of world ranking points.
Okay, now you started, if I got my facts right, Green Square Golf in 2011, so 10 years. So you've been monetizing the golf data that you used to publish for free. So, I mean, if you're doing it to make money, why on earth did you feel the need to publish it for free and share all your hard work with everybody anyway in the first place?
Well, just to clarify, Green Square Golf only started in 2020. But what it represents is what I used to do for free from 2011. The background is I worked in a senior executive position with Tats Group in Australia, got sick of the horrible corporate environment after about 3 years and left and basically semi-retired, went to live with my girlfriend in Indonesia. And I was bored as hell. So I decided to just publish some of the output from my software purely as a vanity exercise and just for fun. And it generated quite a lot of interest. So then I started just producing it for every tournament every week and simultaneously got going on Twitter, 2012, I think it was. And because I didn't need the money from golf betting and never have, it was just fun to share, fun to try and be smarter than the bookies occasionally, fun to Skype about a 100-1 winner who I'd rated 50s, but just a vanity exercise and a bit of fun.
So for that reason, you weren't worried too much of giving away your edge to people. They still need to sift through the form, or do they just follow do you sort of rate your selections and are the selections ready-made or do people still need to do a bit of work?
Well, I didn't always publish my prices for each event. And on an event where I thought I really had an edge, I never published my prices. So the sheets were just form. So there was no extra IP revealed systematically. It was just occasional. And in fact, I've probably gone 1 or 2 years on occasion without publishing any of my prices. And because it was free, no one could really complain. But it was all really just fun. Up until my wife gave birth to twins in 2019 and started giving me a hard time about how much time I was spending on the laptop. So she said, why don't you spend more time with the babies? Or if you're going to spend time on the laptop, make some money out of it. So I didn't really have an answer for that. So decided to see if we could make a bit of money out of it.
Okay. Now, going to the information that is, like I said, I signed up for it. Unfortunately, I haven't paid any money, but I've looked at all the information that you offer on there. Now, you explained earlier that a lot of the events that you list in your weekly updates, I assume, are those obscure, low-grade tournaments that you get your edge from getting to know players before they emerge into the bigger tournaments. Is that correct?
Yes.
Because I ran it by a keen golf bettor, and he's never even seen a lot of these priced up. So are they purely for information purposes, or can you bet on some of those, or would you even think about betting on some of those low-grade golf tournaments?
If there's a market available, yes. And if I have an account with a bookmaker who's betting on them, absolutely. I would much rather bet on those tournaments than on the PGA Tour or European Tour, where there's so much more analysis and so much more disclosure of statistics and the like. There are a lot of lower level tournaments that I never publish a sheet for because there's never going to be a betting market on them. It would just be a waste of time.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that you got tucked up with agents in Hong Kong. So I was going to ask if you have to cash your net wide to bet on worldwide tournaments with local bookmakers. It local to the sort of near the countries they're based in. Is that something that you've already said that you do? I mean, how, just elaborate a bit more about how you would go about opening accounts in far flung places or finding agents to put the money on, or is it a bit clandestine?
It varies. I mean, I needed an account with Skybet recently. I had a relative who was living in the UK. So I got him to open the account and deposit some money and then hand the account credentials over to me. Then I just log in using a VPN as though I'm in the UK. The agent side of things is a little more clandestine, and there are very few companies that allow foreign agents to bet with them. But there is one particular large company that does. I don't really want to mention the name because I don't really want them to know that I'm one of the people who's betting anonymously with them. It's a question of personal contact through Hong Kong Jockey Club, creating a level of trust for me to send 1,000 and then later on more. And then when there's positive funds on the other end, some expectation that you'll get them back.
I want to go back to what you know, the mechanics of the way you sort of play. How many golfers, I know it's a difficult question, but how many golfers would you on average back in a tournament?
On average, 4. And it varies.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I accept that. You know, it's a difficult one to answer accurately, but why is any reason why 4 is the average?
Probably, I mean, there's more to it than just 4. For example, on all the main tours, I won't bet on any golfer who's shorter than 50-1. On ladies and seniors golf, nobody's shorter than 30-1. So on average, I'm looking at a price of maybe 80. So the place component is maybe 16 to 20. 16 to 20 sort of aligns with 4 when you're looking at crossed each way doubles. So in a typical week, there might be 4 tournaments. I may have 4 golfers in each. So I cross them every which way and each way doubles, hoping for 20 with 20, two places, 400 to one. And I do it, I don't want to go into too many details, but I'm betting in units of 10 or 20 cents. So I'm taking those 96 or whatever it is, cross doubles, 5, 10, 20, 50 times each through multiple accounts, multiple bookmakers, none of which accounts are in my name. It all sounds very clandestine, but the modern bookmakers run, bookmaking businesses run by accountants, and accountants don't have any of the ethos or approach to bookmaking that a traditional bookmaker used to have. So if you win, you get chopped. They don't want you.
Now, you're talking big prices there. So by the very nature, even if you're very clever and astute, you're going to have a few gaps between winners. And if you have a look, how many losing sort of tournaments can you cope with before you start getting a bit edgy, or does edgy not happen?
Well, I'm a long way into it now. The average gap between collects is 3 to 4 weeks. So I can go 3 or 4 weeks without any of those golfers placing. But if the fourth week is place, then I'm in profit over those 4 weeks. So yeah, it's averaged out. I haven't worked it out lately, but over that time span we're talking about, 3 or 4 weeks, it's been the typical longest drought. And of course, occasionally, a few times a year, you'll get win-win in a double. It's rare. I think my best ever year was four times. That's the cream on the coffee. If I can get a couple of places every 4 weeks, I'm in profit.
Okay, now you mentioned earlier that you don't actually need to win to live. So I'm assuming that the stress levels are lower than they would be if you were doing it solely for a living. Now, you told me that you completed a business course, midlife, an MBA. Why did you suddenly decide to educate yourself at that sort of age, or educate yourself further?
Well, it's interesting. I was in my late 30s and the company I was working for got taken over, and most of the executives got kicked out, including me. So I went to a major headhunter. This was in New Zealand. Sat down with them and said, I'm looking for a decent executive job. I want a company car. I want perks. I want an expense account. I want a salary of X. And he just sort of said to me, I need to give you a reality check. You're sitting here demanding this, that, and the other thing, and you don't even have an MBA. He said, you're nothing, really. And also, you're getting old. I said, I'm whatever I was, 38, been an executive for 14 years. I've got bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. Admittedly, the master's was in arts. He said, get yourself an MBA, otherwise you're just going to get left behind. So that was what triggered me to go and do that. Also cost me my first marriage.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, by the way, but you've since then you consulted to 34 gambling companies, been a CEO and a board member on several of those. Has that been an aid to your understanding of how the bookmaking sort of works and getting around not being able to get bets on? Has that been a help or an insight?
It has helped somewhat. I mean, I've been involved with African sports betting since 2014, so really disconnected from the mainstream world. But yes, knowing the inside workings of bookmakers and bookmaking businesses has helped a bit. And also being on the inside, observing the habits of professional gamblers and professional syndicates has been quite a big help as well, I think.
And how big a thing is that? I mean, are there more than people would imagine out there?
It's phenomenal. I'll give you an example. I was working for a company in Australia called Centrebet, which was one of the early pioneers in online betting, and we're expanding into Europe. And there was a guy who was kicking our ass at soccer every week. Every week he was making money. And then one of my bookmakers discovered a similar pattern of bets on another account. And eventually we found that there were 70 accounts having the same bets every week, and they were all beating us. And all roads led back to a guy in Italy, in a little walled town called, beautiful little town, Lucca. So I went there, said he was a, got in touch with him, told me he was a VIP client, I wanted to meet him. So we met at lunch, started on a few wines, and I said to him, "What the fuck are you doing to us? Who are you?" And it turned out that yes, he had a team of 70 guys, but he was only one of 14 such guys around the world who each had a team of 50 to 70. They were all working for one Croatian guy, Swedish Croatian. And this guy would SMS them teams and a minimum price. He would send an SMS out on Mondays when the soccer markets opened. And immediately the 14 main guys would communicate with their 50 or 70 subsidiary guys. And they would all start betting small amounts, $10, $20, $50 on all of these football teams until the global price hit a certain level when they just stopped. It was unbelievable. It was like octopus tentacles spreading right around the world.
Amazing.
And yeah, there were arguably 700 guys betting on behalf of this one person.
And did you find out what, I don't suppose the guy knew, how they were doing it? You know, actually getting the winners, because it's easy enough, if getting on's a problem, but you still got to win, haven't you?
Sorry, a helicopter just went past the window. I just missed that.
I mean, I'm guessing that as the guy was just an agent as such, and you didn't find out how they were beating the book so well. I mean, I know getting on, but they've still got to win, haven't they? What their process of finding the winners was?
I found out a little bit, but it was all anecdotal. I never got to meet the main guy, but apparently he had a database which included every football player in the world, and it included things like pitch condition and wind and all sorts of things. And as soon as he had a rough idea of the lineup for each team, he would run this match through his database and spit out a price, which might be, say, even money, 2.00. So if the bookmakers opened 250 or 240, that was one of the ones that they'd be targeting.
Well, is it still operating? Do you know this syndicate?
I don't know. I left Centrebet about a year later. I actually took the guy in Lucca on as a consultant to the business on football for $6,000 a week, I think it was, just so that he and his compadres would stay away. We don't know whether they stayed away, but our soccer win percentage improved.
Now, you say you moved to Africa 2013 and set up a sports betting company. Now operates in 7 countries. I assume that means that Africa is a growth continent. And what would be the sort of things they bet on? What's your main business?
It's 93% soccer, football. Everything else is a sideshow. Soccer is just universally loved, and they're fanatical about it throughout Africa. It's one of our 2 reasons for coming here in the first place. The other was the emergence of mobile money as a means of money transfer.
Okay, and have you encountered any similar sort of syndicates based in Africa that you've had to be a bit wary of?
No, not at all. Each African business is like in a capsule, so it's you're only able to bet with it if you have a phone number and a mobile money account in that country. So the opportunities for external syndicates to come in and bet are limited. And also the average bet size is obviously much smaller than in the West. The average bet when I was in the industry in Australia was maybe $12. In Africa, it's less than $1. Right. So if someone was coming in bigger, you'd notice them pretty quickly.
Then I was pleased for you and interested to see that you've retired for the third time in 2017. Have you stayed retired?
Yeah, I retired in 1995 with what I thought was an inexhaustible amount of money. It was after my divorce. We sold the house, we sold everything. I think I had $360,000. So I just went on holiday, stayed in hotels, gambled, chased women, traveled to all the countries I wanted to travel to. And yeah, suddenly in 1997, I was broke. So I mentioned earlier, 2011, when I left Tats Group, I had quite a bit of money. So I retired to Indonesia, but then as Asian women are wont to do, this one extracted a lot of money from me for family and for motorbikes and for a house and for a couple of cars and some holidays. So a few years later, I found myself broke again. So then I got into this African venture, and I cashed out a few shares in 2017, and I've been living off that since.
Okay, now finally, I was interested in this, and it's the final question. I hope you don't mind me bringing it up. You mentioned that your father was a compulsive losing punter on horse racing. Do you think that experience had any bearing on you, making you determined to be able to beat the bookmakers? Do you think that was anything that was, in a roundabout way, what made you so keen to do what you do?
I don't know. There's certainly gambling in my genes, and it goes back to other branches of the family and back to my grandmother's generation. My grandmother was a bookmaker in Wellington in New Zealand in the 1940s. But I think the lesson I took from what happened to my father, he finished up extorting money from his employer and losing it all gambling. Eventually got caught after a few years, got sentenced to 4 years in jail, served about 2 years, 8 months. The lesson I took out of it was that he used to back two or three favourites in every horse race. And, you know, obviously got some winners, but went broke doing it. So I think the one lesson I took away from it was that I was never going to be a favourites better in any form of gambling. I was always more leaning towards the longer shots.
Okay, now you've got your golf sort of nice and stable now. Are you happy with what you're doing now, or is there something next?
We want to greatly evolve the Green Square Golf Service to incorporate fantasy golf, DraftKings and FanDuel salaries. We're going to produce our own salaries as well, just for reference. We're just at the end of a development phase at the moment, which got really fucked over by COVID-19, but we're about to make all the form data points in our sheets clickable so people can see which tour, how strong the field was, when it was, and so on. And we've got a number of other developments lined up. So yeah, that's sort of exciting for this year, for 2021. But beyond that, that's sort of too far away to think. I never look too far ahead. So my focus at the moment is just on some golf tournaments next week, and in the longer term, just the enhancement of the Green Square Golf Service. And also relocating the hell out of Africa and going to live somewhere a bit more civilized. So we're thinking New Zealand.
Excellent. Well, on that note, Mike, we do appreciate you giving us your time today. Thank you very much. We'll put the website on the down below in the comments, so anybody can go and check out what you do. And Mike Miller, thank you very much.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Simon.
You can follow Star Sports on Twitter at @StarSports_bet, our Facebook page at Star Sports Bet, and also view all our latest videos on YouTube at Star Sports. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.